At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm Mel Barrett.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie.
Welcome to Something's Off, which is a new podcast for us and a video experiment as well.
Something's off, Mel. Something's off.
A new ASMR channel. No, I'm just kidding. Can you imagine? So, maybe we should do that.
I don't
should
have
tell
the
all
voice
these
for that.
True crime stories where we're like, and then he dismembered her.
And then we tap our nails in the mic like. No, I can't do that.
Yeah, we can't do that. I don't have the patience for it. I love ASMR, but I don't have the patience for it. Anyway, Rebecca and I are joining up for this new adventure because we had so much fun with the readathon. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this is going to be sort of similar to the readathon, but we're going to cover more cases. We're going to talk about a lot more stuff.
Right.
So I'm glad to be here with you. I love being on camera with you, although this is sort of a new one for us. We only record video every once in a while for the readathon.
Well, because I forget.
This is going to be. She's like, oh, shit, I forgot to record. So I'm going to try to remember to record every time because we are going to also release this on YouTube as well as our Patreon. So Crime Writers on Patreon, the In-Between Patreon and YouTube. I will put a link in the show notes for our new YouTube, which I have to tell you, Rebecca, there's no content on it besides the little trailer that I cut together. But
which
we already have 125 subscribers.
Who are these people?
I don't know, but I love them. So.
Should we, by the way, just tell people who don't know who we are, like who we are briefly, just so that they're not looking for like idiots blathering. Although, you know, you could argue that everybody is an idiot blathering. But By day, I'm a journalist. I work at New Hampshire Public Radio. I oversee the podcast team there, and I used to work in the newsroom. And then I have been host of the long-running podcast, Crime Writers On which we critique true crime media, talk about the ethics of the criminal legal system and the media around it, and we talk about films and documentaries and other podcasts. And I also host a podcast for Netflix called You Can't Make This Up, in which I interview directors of documentaries on Netflix, and we make a podcast about Law and Order and SVU called These Are Their Stories, which is very silly.
Yeah, you're not busy at all.
No, I'm fine. It's totally
now you have this one, too.
Oh, I also go on Core TV once in a while to talk about stuff.
Oh, you
do. Vinny
Politan. I didn't get to see, you were on last night, and I didn't get to see it, but I'm gonna watch it today.
I'll tell you about it.
I am Mel Barrett. I don't do quite as much as Rebecca because I'm a little bit of a noob, but I am the investigative journalist and podcast host of the In-Between podcast, which is sort of like an investigative true crime. I try to do these long, you know, longer running series, like 6 to 8 episodes about a case that I'm investigating. My first season was about Pam Smart. Mm-hmm. And I have got some updates and news coming about Pam Smart in the next few days, which I'm excited about. And I've got a new season coming out that's going to air with Grab Bag in November about a serial rapist that invaded a community in Morgantown, West Virginia in the late 80s and early 90s. And
wow.
I will give you a little bit of a hint. I am starting to think that maybe he didn't do it.
Oh.
Yeah. It's very interesting. But that'll be out in November.
Sounds like something's off.
Something's off for sure. Was there anything off about your week?
Well, I just want to briefly tell you about this case I talked about on Core TV last night, which I'm now completely obsessed with. So the way that it works transparently is I get a booking text or email from the producer there, Brittany, who's awesome. And she's like, do you want to come on talk with Vinny tomorrow night at 9 about X? And sometimes I just can't because I have other plans. But sometimes I look at the case and I'm like, I wouldn't be comfortable talking about this one because either it overlaps with my professional life or because I know if I don't know everything about it, it'll be a problem. But most of the time, it's like something I can catch up on. And I know they're only going to ask me a couple questions and it's going to be about the weird whatever about. And I'm super interested in that. And so yesterday, they asked me to go on to talk about this case, which has an overlap with another one of my interests, which is the Amish community.
Oh, right.
So this is a case in Ohio. It's a guy named Samuel Hochstetler. He was arrested at 18. He was 18 years old. He was arrested in May for a rape murder that had occurred a couple months before that. The victim was named Roseanne Kissinger. Now, I'm not weighing in on whether or not he did it or not, because signs point to that he likely did this crime, although there's a huge problem with his confession and a huge problem with the case generally about his mens rea, his like knowingness of the fact that it was a crime. He's Amish, and Amish are not a monolith. There's like 40 different sects of Amish people. There's 350,000 of them. They're not all the same, but the thing they have in common is they're all very insular, and there is a generational history of rape, abuse, incest, trauma in this community, because they don't talk to the outside world and they don't talk to each other about anything. So, for instance, a sister could be getting raped by her brother, and her other sister could be asleep right next to her and be pretending to be asleep because they are both being abused and they don't talk about it. So, and there's also a lot of questions about whether or not the concepts of sex, rape, consent are even something that, you know, younger Amish people especially are even aware of, because they're not taught anything about it. They have no TV. They have no radio. They have no, you know, cultural sense of normality, or what we think of as normality in terms of like safety, relationships, et cetera. So that's an interesting aspect of it. But the other thing that's interesting is that this guy, Samuel, when he was interrogated by police, his native language is Pennsylvania Dutch. It is hard for the untrained ear or the untrained person with languages to understand this, because when he speaks English, he speaks it with an American accent and he sounds like he speaks English just fine. But keep in mind, that's because all the English he knows, he learned from American people who speak English. So why would he have a German accent or whatever, right? But there's basic concepts that he clearly does not understand in this interrogation. He says he doesn't know what the word sex means. He doesn't know what the word rape means. He doesn't understand the process kind of that he's involved in.
Whoa.
And the police said to him, the only way God will forgive you is if you tell us what happened. So they promised absolution to a deeply faithful person who doesn't understand concepts like the police can lie, or that I won't be able to be let go after. I mean, he doesn't know concept of any of this. And so the judge is considering whether or not to throw out the confession, which I've heard in large part the tapes, and they are extremely problematic. It's very, very clear that this young man doesn't understand. And as you know, I'm a person that really believes that even the person who did the very worst thing in the world has the same rights as the rest of us have. Think about the sweetest, kindest, most vulnerable person you know in an interrogation situation, and they didn't do a crime, and then apply how you feel about that to everyone, because that's how it should be applied. And that's kind of what's happening here. And I honestly have deep questions too about whether or not he, because he's not stupid, but culturally speaking, he says his victim didn't speak, she didn't do anything. And it's like, but that is the culture of violent sexual crime in this community. And he's 18, like, would he know? So anyway, there's a lot of questions. I am not in any way saying that this crime wasn't a crime. I'm not saying she's not a real victim, because she is a horrible crime. And I'm not saying he didn't do it. I'm just saying something's off with the process here.
Absolutely. And let me ask you a couple of questions. So let's say, like, hypothetically, the judge rules in a way that says, okay, this guy didn't know what he did was wrong. And he was sort of coerced by cops that he didn't understand the process. What do you think the punishment should be if they are able to technically prove that he sexually assaulted this woman or raped this woman?
And murdered
this woman. Like, murder is the, if it were just a sexual assault case, that'd be one thing. But the murder on top of it.
Yeah.
If they can actually factually prove that he did it, what should his punishment be?
Well, if the confession is out, I mean, when there is a video that shows when he was arrested, they told him they were going to bring him in for a DNA test. So as far as I'm concerned, any DNA collected is fair game. I don't know what kind of DNA evidence there is that didn't come up at the preliminary hearing. It was all about the confession. If the confession is out, chances are they will go more. I mean, I don't understand why they're not mostly pursuing the murder part anyway, given all the problematic nature of the potential mens rea and stuff. I believe the law in Ohio is you don't need to know that something, you don't have to intend to be committing a crime. If you commit it, you can still be punished for it. But there is a mens rea exception where if you don't even understand something is a crime, then you might sort of look at it, you might look at the case differently. So I think there's a lot of questions about the sexual assault aspect of this. Not that he didn't do it, but that was he even aware there is such a thing as sexual assault? He didn't seem to think so in his. And I'll tell you, there's no reason to believe when you hear these tapes that he's not being truthful because he's so confused, so clearly confused. I mean, and the language barrier is amazing. Like they talk about how he killed her and apparently she was asphyxiated as, and there was also some like physical pressure on her. But he says, I put, what is the thing you put over your body like a sheet, but to keep you warm in the winter? And they were like, a blanket. And he's like, is that what you call it? A blanket? And so there's just so clearly some, they should have had a translator. There's issues in translation. I think the murder thing is going to be more cut and dried for them to pursue.
Well, let me ask you another question then. As far as the murder is concerned, so do you understand how the murder happened? Like that you have that information or he was sort of mealy-mouthed about it?
It seems like he wasn't able to explain it well because he went afterwards immediately and fell to his knees and prayed and he was feeling off. He kept describing himself as feeling off.
That's funny.
Yeah, it seems like there may have been a dissociative incident or something or sex went wrong. But he didn't, maybe didn't understand how it was supposed to go right. And she died. Now, granted, he knew she died. So that's where obviously he should have gone and told somebody.
Yes.
The woman's dead. And he didn't. Like they were missing her for 2 days and then they went to look for her and then they found her dead. So there's clearly some understanding there that it wasn't great because he didn't tell anyone. So
well, it seems like he tried to cover it up if they couldn't find her.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway.
See, I know that, I mean, the Amish understand murder. They understand that, maybe they don't. I don't know. I don't know if that's true or not.
I think they do. I mean, they just don't have. Okay, I think about the Karen Reed case.
Yeah.
Remember when there was an argument in the pretrial hearings about whether or not they should bring on the witness who was a former FBI agent to talk about what a proper investigation should look like?
Right.
And Judge Cannone said no. Because everyone knows what a proper investigation is.
But,
which is, by the way, not true. But also, how does everyone ostensibly know that? They know that from TV. They know it from newspapers. They know it from cases that have been overturned. They know it from their pop culture influences.
Yeah.
None of those exist here. Mm-mm. So he doesn't have a basis of understanding for Miranda. He doesn't have a basis. So I'm granted, I know that they know murder is wrong because that's like a tenet of the Bible, right? They know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the complications around how a murder could happen, could it be seen as an accident by the community and reported that way? Would the community have reported him? There's a lot of questions. The community ultimately did call the police, so they knew something had happened. But yeah, it's complicated and it's off and it's very interesting and I will be continuing to follow it.
What if somebody within the community is advising him to play up his Amish card like he doesn't know what happened? Ooh.
It could be. But if you hear these tapes, he's not bright enough to act that well. It's very clear. He's just he's not stupid. He's just a very straightforward, for lack of a better word, simple, farmy Amish guy. And he did recently move from Kentucky, which raises questions about why he moved from one community. There's a lot of questions about him and his history. Who knows? And again, I am not saying he didn't do it. And I'm not saying he's not a bad person. But the issues with the investigation are, I've never seen anything like
this
it. And even Vinnie Politan said, I have never seen or heard anything like this. So that's saying
something. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
There's so much they have to figure out before they can even get to the crime.
Right.
About how the understanding, it's very interesting. I'm hoping that we can dig into that a little bit deeper in another episode. One of the things, though, that I did want to talk about was this morning, there was an update in the Sandra Birchmore case.
Tell me about that.
Very quickly, it's not a huge update, but the trial has been set for October 5th, 2026.
There hasn't been any pretrial hearings yet.
They have set the trial. They have, and the judge is saying, we're going to move forward whether we're deciding if it's a death penalty case or not. The defense is saying that they need more than a year to prepare for a capital case.
Yeah.
And also, I guess in my brain, this whole time I was thinking he was going to take a plea.
Well, he was arrested more than a year ago. He was arrested, I believe, in August of 2024.
Mm-hmm.
There has not been a single court appearance. And they have, every single time there's supposed to be a court appearance, they have delayed it. And I've been following a reporter from the LA Times, Michelle McGee, is that her name? Who basically, she tweets about Michelle McPhee. She tweets about this a lot. I've been following her reporting. She's originally from Boston, so she has like she also did some great work on the Karen Reed case. And she has been basically posting every single time this thing is delayed. And it is there's really no reason why a federal case with so much evidence would see so many delays unless there was stuff happening behind the scenes. And people thought for a while maybe he's flipping on people, maybe, and maybe he is, but maybe the judge has just had it with
I think
the
that's what it feels like. Yeah. Yeah. That's what it feels like from today. I just read a Boston 25 article about it. And basically she was like, it doesn't matter whether we decide death penalty or not. We're moving forward October 5th, 2026. Yeah. So that's the one big update. I'm really happy to hear it because I do hope this one goes to trial. This is another case like Karen Reed where we need to understand the inner workings of our police departments and our state police and the FBI and all that. And I feel like this case
and
is
the,
one of those
the State Department of Justice.
Yeah, the AGs, the DAs, all that, you know. And there's so much. It's interesting because that we're talking about that case, you know, we obviously covered Karen Reed. One of the cases we're going to be talking about today after we get through, you know, a little bit more about what's been happening in our lives.
Some gossip. About Karen Reed. And
yeah. Is the Brian Walsh case, which is another case, you know, Yuri Bukenik, Michael Proctor, both involved in that case. And we'll talk about it in a little bit. But can we talk just briefly about some Karen Reed updates? There's been so much going on since August, basically.
Can we just get the gossip part out of the way first?
Let's do it.
The stuff that's been going on.
Drama is crazy.
There's so many people covering this that I don't want to get into the weeds with it. But in case you haven't heard, the broad brushstrokes are that Turtle Boy, Aidan Carney, is being accused of recording conversation with Karen Reed, which, by the way, in Massachusetts is illegal without two-party consent,
also in New Hampshire.
Yep. Ostensibly, the allegations are, and I've heard the tape, and I've heard it on social media, and it's pretty clear to me as that somebody was recording the tape that was being played for them from a device. So I don't think in any way, if this happened, that the tape came from him, the public version of the tape. I think somebody he played it for recorded it and released it. That's kind of clear what happened. But there apparently has been this big breach of trust between the two of them, which was fomenting before. It was fomenting before his show at the Wilbur. It was like he was talking
about
it. The Howie Carr
is like the trigger point,
thing,
I think.
You know, he'd been saying things like, you know, I should be thanking Karen Reed, like in a sarcastic way. So clearly they have, you know, parted ways maybe as potential friends if that was ever going to happen. But she has been now talking in the comments and going and speaking to other content creators like JFK and James, et cetera, Athan, about, you know, that she's really angry about it. And so the entire Free Karen Reed movement seems to be really split and divided. Sure. And now it's like, people hate Turtle Boy. People hate JFK. People are like, Turtle Boy, ride or die. He saved her life, blah, blah, blah. It is ugly. It is unpleasant. I usually don't watch any of these long live streams, but I've been watching them just to sort of see what the rhetoric is and how people are talking about it. Yeah. I watched a long one of Turtle Boys. I've watched The Young Jerks. I watched JFK. I will say one real one out of this whole thing is Mike Crawford from Young Jerks.
Young Jerks, yep.
He is, I think, always exceptionally fair. Mm-hmm. He is very clear. He went on the Turtle Boy stream the other day, which I think took a lot of balls because he was taking a lot of shit, especially from this guy, the Glarer, who's been a real shit stirrer. Mm-hmm. And he's basically like, listen, Aidan, you need to knock this off. Like, you need to tell people to knock it off. You need to knock it off, whatever. And you know, Aidan Carney, he digs in.
He said it in the live the other night that his baseline is revenge. I mean, he said that. He said revenge.
And he digs in. And this is the thing. And like, if I were to have a private conversation with him, what I would say is like, you're hubris about digging in. And I understand that he has a lot of well-founded grievances, especially with the justice system in Massachusetts, where he's still being persecuted for things that are not crimes.
He's facing 105 years in jail.
Right. Except that they can't now find a prosecutor for many of his cases, which is very interesting because of that whole thing. Look at Sue O'Donnell's
O'Connell.
great I always say O'Donnell because of Nora O'Donnell on CBS. Mm-hmm. Anyway, look at Sue O'Connell's recent Instagram video. She encapsulates the story very well. Of course, he's been reporting on it, but she has this like 1 minute recap about the prosecutor situation, which is great. Has to do with Lindsay Gaetani, who's now like on the verge of saying Karen Reid didn't do it. She's like so close.
Not only is she on the verge of saying Karen Reid didn't do it, she's also not on the verge, but jumped over in saying that Jen McCabe
was actually puppet master.
So yeah, look at those videos. It's crazy.
I don't find her to be a trustworthy narrator in any way. However, seeing this whole thing sort of disintegrate, it was completely predictable and is kind of juicy. But anyway, there's this huge division. It's a whole thing happening. I'm just going to say for the record, I don't know really any of these people. The only person I've talked to at any kind of length is Aiden Carney Turtleboy, who I have, even though he has done some things that I have literally told him, like, I would never fucking do that. I would never say that. Like, he'll say things. He said a thing on a stream the other day about libs of TikTok saying all she's doing is pointing out the shitty behavior of other people. I'm like, no, she's lying about what people did. Like, he definitely has a worldview that's very different from mine. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Of course, I weirdly also have this like older sisterly affection toward him. Mm-hmm. Like, he reminds me of people I know. I understand his sort of aggrieved stance. I think a lot of what he does is really is needed in the media sphere. So like, I have affection toward him. It doesn't mean that I'm like ride or die if he does anything that's like egregious and awful, but I do understand him and he digs in. Like, he digs in. Like, he's on his back feet. He feels whatever. And he's like, well, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you.
Yeah.
And if anyone is sort of aligning with him, he embraces them, even if he's not somebody he would normally like. And if anyone is against him, and that's why I think that Mike Crawford was so ballsy for going on his stream, because Mike is a universally liked guy who's now being attacked. And he's like, this isn't good. He's like, I'm losing subscribers. People don't trust me. You need to help cool. You are one of the only people. You and Karen Reid are the only people with the power to cool this whole thing down. And neither one of you were doing that. And
Because they're both hotheads.
She can't be asked to do anything right now because she's still like, you know, the Karen Reid of it all. And she's being sued and all this stuff. He can't say a lot of things out loud because he's in legal peril. And some of the things he could say out loud could get him in more trouble. It is a fucking mess. So anyway, that's what's going on.
It is. And they're... It's a fucking mess, and they're the nucleus of a bunch of sort of crazies.
Yes.
So, you know, this guy, the glarer, Will, when Mike confronted Aiden about Will, he was like, what do you want me to do? I've told him to not say certain things. I can't control him. He's going out there and do-do-do. But it's sort of like when I heard him say those things, like Mike is saying, calm your people down. They're acting crazy. They're going to cause problems. They're going to maybe violence, maybe something. It reminded me of, you know, a certain base in our political sphere that gets riled up by the leader and can't be tamped down by the leader. And the leader doesn't want to tamp them down.
Right. But I mean, what he says is I say things and I don't tell people to do things. I'll say maybe technically that's true. I think what Mike was saying was not that you can control your followers, but that you can characterize this differently. You can maybe do more olive branchy type stuff. You can maybe try to make peace behind the scenes a little harder. You can do those things. Yeah. And he may have been doing those things. I don't know. I'm not saying he hasn't. But I think Mike was saying like the temperature, generally speaking, not just on the mic, but off the mic, are all of our temperatures need to come down. And granted, everyone's taking their eye off the ball now. Like, whether you can fucking hate Turtle Boy, but think about what I said before. Think about the nicest, most vulnerable person you know being wrongly prosecuted for trumped up charges in order to get dirt on a murder case that they felt like embarrassed they weren't able to bring home. Like, that is what's going on here. And he's being really persecuted. He's not helping with some of the things he does, obviously, but it shouldn't be happening. And that's your eye on the prize. The civil suit is your eye on the prize. Karen Reid potentially suing all the McAlberts, eye on the prize. The fact that now they are both being investigated again by the Norfolk County DA's office for witness intimidation, and apparently they're trying to convene a new grand jury, that is criminal. And that's what everybody, in my opinion, like if you can, push some of this noise away and don't forget about those things.
And I think, but the issue is this is what we talked about right at the end of the trial. And I said on one of our readathon episodes, my fear is that they're not going to know what to do with themselves anymore.
Yeah.
And this is what's happening because they don't know what to do with themselves. They don't have trial every day to watch and commentate on.
They don't have an audience.
They don't have
as big of an audience.
They don't have as big of an audience. And so they're just burning the house down because they want to talk about something. That's what it feels like to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I am really concerned. I'm going to say this about the Karen Reed situation. I'm concerned about the fact that they are still holding two of her cell phones.
Yes.
And that they are investigating and potentially calling another grand jury to bring charges against her for witness intimidation. They have got to let this woman go.
Do you believe for a second that they haven't already searched those phones?
No, they've had them for what, 3 years?
I don't
this
believe it
either.
It's my opinion.
It feels like
that they have probably already searched those phones.
That's my opinion as well. And my opinion is that her rights are being trampled on every day. They hold those phones.
They're grand jury shopping. Yeah.
Because, they're grand jury shopping. Whether they do it or not, the threat that it's there, the idea that she's living, you know, she's free right now, but they could take that back any second. That's what it feels like to me.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they go through this or not, whether they charge her with anything or not, they're doing the same thing they've been doing to Aiden, which is the threat of taking your freedom away is there and we have the power, you don't.
That's right.
And
they're humiliated and they're continuing to try to save face. And when you have Sue O'Connell making videos saying, this is unbelievable, like very measured commentator and reporter and has really been trying to keep her nose clean and was very transparent about not being able to comment on the Aiden Carney thing because she also covers him in the newsroom. It's like, she is, you know, you have a Boston reporter saying this is unbelievable. That isn't Howie Carr, who's not a reporter, by the way. So
anyway,
so that's what's going on there. If you're interested in the gossip, look at Lindsay Gaetani's Twitter. Look at Mike Crawford. Watch a few minutes of any of these streams.
Yeah, the last stream that was out, the last live stream that Aiden did, I think is important. It's the one that Mike came on. I thought Mike handled himself really well, and he wasn't afraid to challenge Aiden. And the thing that here's where my respect lies with Aiden is that he is willing to be challenged, and he will talk it out with
you. He can take it. Yeah,
he can defend himself or not. You can have a disagreement. You can debate. I think we have lost the ability to debate in this country
in good faith.
In
the
good
ability
faith.
To debate in good. There's plenty of ability to debate.
Yeah.
Not in good faith, which is what you're seeing defended as real debate, but it's not. It's not really a debate when you know what you're saying isn't true and it's all about goading and it's all about trying to trick people. That's not a debate. A debate is a free exchange of ideas. Here's what I think. Okay, I heard you, but here's why I disagree. Like, that's a debate.
Yeah. The only other update, I think, with Karen Reed is that the judge did rule on the case dismissal, the motion that was put through from the defense to dismiss the case. He seems like a very balanced, fair judge. I'll say that. He dismissed the part of the suit that dealt with Kaylee.
Kaylee, yeah.
So he dismissed that part of the suit that dealt with Kaylee. So the rest of it stands. But I felt like he combed through their motion and he figured out what was right and what was wrong and he ruled on it. And I feel like that's pretty fair.
Yeah. I think I'm always reticent to say that these judges are problematic because they have a job and they interpret the law and they're not looking at all the live streams we're looking at. They don't have like all this context. They don't have whatever. And I know people have criticisms of him for other cases or whatever, but in this matter, he does seem balanced. He's willing to listen to even things that seem like a stretch. I don't believe he's going to let Karen's countersuit be rolled into this proceeding. I really don't. And I don't understand why they argued it that way, except I think that it was just public. It was just to announce it was happening.
Publicity. Yeah.
But I'm also looking forward to seeing what comes of that. We'll see.
I am too. Should we talk about what we're here to talk about?
Oh, we're here to talk about something else? Yes. Let's talk about Brian Walsh, another case that I'm very interested in, but you know a lot more about than I do.
I know a little bit. I've been trying to look into. So the things that are interesting to me about this case are the things that were happening before the murder happened. So I'm just going to do a really quick like Cliff Notes version of what happened for the audience in case they're not familiar. Anna Walsh, Brian Walsh were married. They had three kids. They lived in Boston.
Boston's a region. It's like Los Angeles. And like people talk about the towns all around Boston as if it's Boston. And people who live in those towns are like, it's not Boston. It's X. It's a whole thing. Yeah. So just saying Boston is safe as far as this is a safe
space. This was Boston. They lived in Boston proper, though.
Okay.
They
lived this is a safe space, though, to fuck it up and say Boston when it's actually like, you know, some other town, like, you know, one of those
towns. I know. Well, it's not like Andover or like, you know.
It's not Lowell. Like
no. It's not Lowell. It's not Lynn. You're not from that area. You're from
I'm from Long Island originally, but I know a lot about the pronunciation.
Lin Lin, City of Sin.
No.
Lin Lin. My grandmother used to say this to me. Lin Lin, City of Sin. You never come out the way you went in.
Oh, that sounds right. I would say Lowell, is it Methuen and Lowell have a similar
vibe? And Lowell. Yeah. Anyway. These people lived in Boston proper, and they were, for all intents and purposes, very well off. Anna was a real estate developer. She worked for a company in D.C. She traveled quite a bit. They had three young children. Where we start this story is Anna sort of going back and forth to D.C. from their Boston home. And Brian is on house arrest because he is a scam artist. He basically purchased these Andy Warhol paintings, originals from a friend in South Korea, brought them back, and then had them reproduced, and then tried to sell them on eBay as the originals.
I forgot about the art part of this.
Yes. So he was found out. He accepted the money from this person who negotiated off of eBay with him. The assistant came to pick up the paintings, took them back. Brian cashed the check. And then the person who purchased them was like, these have staples in them and brand new canvas. Yes. So they're not real. And
they're from Michael's Crafts.
Yeah, exactly. He like put them together and stapled them himself, which, you know, is kind of on par. And that seems like what he does in other areas, too. So a federal investigation happened and he was indicted. And so he had an ankle monitor on and was supposed to be staying home. This all happened around New Year's Eve, 2022. So something happened. It must've been the pandemic.
Something in the water.
21, 22, Karen Reed, Sandra Birchmore, something happened in Boston.
It's like in the '70s when there were all those serial killers.
Yeah. It's crazy. Well, there are serial killers that are happening right now that we should talk about as well.
Allegedly.
But, allegedly. In a couple of different areas in the country, which I'm really excited about.
so
not
sick.
Because people are dying.
Yay!
But it's just like really interesting.
I know. It's intriguing to parse and talk about. I agree. I'm just saying this is the shit that makes people roll their eyes. At
I know.
Like us.
I know.
That and like bloody handprints on the art, which we did not do, by the way. Congratulations to us.
You told me not to.
No crime scene tape, no bloody handprints.
What I mean is I'm excited to talk about it with you.
To learn about
because
it.
Because the psychology of all of this is so interesting to me, and I want to understand us better as human beings.
Okay.
So that's the longer answer for excited.
Okay, little Miss Behavioral Analysis Unit over there.
Hey. Okay, so New Year's Eve 2022, they have a New Year's Eve party. Anna leaves a note on this champagne box that says, this is going to be our year. I love you. Everything's great. We're going to have a great year.
What could possibly go wrong after
that? What could possibly go wrong?
That's like the opening to a Dateline episode. She lit up a room and she had optimistic hopes for the future, as evidenced by this note she left on this champagne box.
And she felt so safe, she left the door unlocked.
Yeah.
Yeah. So New Year's
in their leafy neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly.
Just closing the door. Right.
Okay.
So New Year's Eve comes and goes. By the 4th of January, no one knows where Anna is. She has completely disappeared, leaving her three young children with Brian at home.
Yeah.
So the real estate company she works for, the developer she works for in DC, basically says, hey, this woman never showed up for work. We don't know where she is. Her husband doesn't know where she is. And so the police start investigating. And we have a familiar name here, Yuri Bukenik.
Ooh,
gets shipped to D.C. From the Karen Reed case. And to interview a lover of Anna's.
Okay.
And they find out that for the past like 6 months or so, Anna's been in this relationship with this guy in D.C. They're very open about their relationship in D.C. It's gotten very serious over the past few months.
Okay.
And Anna has her own place in D.C. She has an apartment there, which Yuri, the investigators say, is already set up for the kids to come and live there.
So she's planning an exit from this relationship.
That's what it seems like.
Yeah. And I wonder why.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, Brian has hired a private investigator because he thinks she's having an affair.
Right.
The private investigator goes to D.C., starts following this guy and is reporting back. And so all of this stuff is happening in their lives. It seems like Anna's about to leave him. He's and been indicted for, you know, federal crimes of, you know, the art fraud and all that stuff. He also, his father died previously, and he wasn't a part of the will, but he somehow conned, not sure how this happened, stole a house out from underneath his family from the will.
Okay.
I don't know. So all this stuff, Anna has
He's a shortcut taker. Like, we've heard of this personality type before, right? Somebody who's always looking for the easy shortcut, cutting corners. They could be using the same energy to just be doing great due diligence and making money at their actual skilled job. But instead, it's like, how can I scheme this? How can I get that? And you're always like, why are you doing this? It takes so much more energy to tell all these lies than tell the truth. Like, he's one of those people.
Yeah. And nobody in their lives knew about that.
Yeah.
He
has mental health issues, something that's now coming to light, which, you know, we shouldn't like diminish that because he is currently in a mental health facility being evaluated for competence for trial, which, by the way, is good. A lot of more people should be evaluated for competence at trial. But anyway, go ahead.
Agreed. So basically, Anna is missing. The police start investigating. They immediately hone in on him because I think of everything that's going on. And she had also, a couple months earlier with her new job, basically signed off on over $2 million worth of life insurance that would go to him if anything happened to her.
Yeah.
So obviously they're like, this is the guy. They start looking at his electronics and they start going through the ankle monitor and his whereabouts over the past few days. And they find that he's gone to Home Depot and bought over $400 worth of basically a dismemberment kit.
Murder supplies,
a full-on Tyvek suit, saws, all kinds of crazy shit.
Plastic, tape, all that stuff. Shovels, whatever. Yeah.
The weirdest detail is after that, he went to CVS and he bought 15 different kinds of peroxide. I didn't know there were 15 different kinds of peroxide.
Different concentrations, different brands, all of it.
I don't know. But anyway, he went through all of that. They also found on the iPad of his oldest son a bunch of searches about the best state to get divorced in, the worst state to get divorced in, how long does it take for life insurance policies to pay off, how to dismember a body, what does
ammonia
do?
Smelling. I've seen some of these, and they are like, for all the seriousness of this case, these are some of the most cartoonish Google searches. It's like you couldn't make it up. It's like,
no.
How to most efficiently dismember a body, where to dispose of body parts where they won't be found. And these are just, I'm paraphrasing, but that is how cartoonish they are.
Yep. And so the police are like, oh shit, he did something bad here.
Or the son did. How old is the son? Like 8?
No, he's like this little kid. So they start realizing, well, and it's on his, he said his phone was missing or dead or something like that. They find his phone.
Yeah.
He also, they have him on surveillance camera going to several different dumpsters across the state. Like across the state. So one in one dumpster in one part, one in on the other side. And he's throwing, you know, big bags of trash in the dumpsters.
Fun fact.
The issue.
Fun
yes,
fact, by the way. They're actually like commercial waste receptacles. Dumpster is a brand name. Okay. Continue.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But you can call them
idea.
Dumpsters. It's like Q-tip.
Well, the craziest thing is that one of the things that he researched about these, what did you call them?
Just call them dumpsters. It's fine. They're like commercial waste.
Well, I don't want dumpster to come after me because of about
they
what
won't,
I'm about to
please,
say.
Please, they're going to come after us when everyone uses the word dumpster, like in every murder thing ever. Go ahead.
Okay. So this dumpster, he had done some sort of research to this specific kind of dumpster went to a place that incinerated the trash at 1800 degrees. And to incinerate a body, you have to do, it's 1500 degrees. Don't ask me how I know that. But so anyway, so he knew all about that. They carted the trash off. The issue, there are two issues with this case that I see in going to trial. And one of them is, and this is the most shocking thing to me, there is no body.
Right.
And the state of Massachusetts is charging this guy with first degree murder.
Yeah.
And there is no body. And that may be a difficult case for them to make because there's no body.
It's happened before, but yeah.
Yeah. And then B, the surveillance and the tech side of this case with the phones is already corrupt because of Michael Proctor, Guarino, Yuri Bukenik. They're, the defense is already asking for a lot of the digital technology in this case to be thrown out because of all of that.
Right. And we should mention, I believe that I read this a few months ago, that they relied on Cellbrite technology to do all this phone stuff. And they relied on the other one that's also like the gold standard one. And
yeah, I don't remember the name of it.
Then in the Karen Reed case, the argument was that stuff isn't reliable. Location stuff isn't reliable. Search stuff isn't reliable. Times aren't reliable. So the Walsh team is like, you have these same cops in this other venue saying this stuff is junk. We want to be able to bring that into this case and basically use it to challenge, impeach them, which wouldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the defense has to do their job. So where it stands right now, the hearings keep getting pushed. Brian was also just stabbed in prison. He didn't die. He was taken out and sent to medical. And like you said, he's being evaluated right now for his, you know, mental capacity. His lawyers are, you can tell what the defense is going to be. And the defense is going to be that the tech is off and there's no body. Mm. And they're saying there's no motive.
Yeah.
I can see a motive, but, and I think a jury would see a motive. But anyway, so that's where we are. We're not sure when the actual trial is going to happen in this case, but the hearings keep getting pushed because of him getting stabbed and also because of him, you know, the mental health capacity. So do you have thoughts about this trial?
I do, but I have a question first.
Sure.
Is your dog there? Because I think I hear her.
Oh, sorry. Yes. This is one of the things. This is Ruby.
It's a feature of our show that we need to acknowledge.
I have a French bulldog and she snores.
Yes. And I have a Bernedoodle who's often in the studio who also makes noise and sometimes jumps on the couch with me. Okay.
Good. Yeah. So this is for our audience. If you hear this like sort of snory farting noise, it's not me or Rebecca. It's usually this one. And look, she's like falling asleep. She sits behind me in the chair.
Okay. So my thoughts are that if this goes to trial, he will be convicted, whether there's a body or not, because I really don't think that, you know, even with impeachability here, with the evidence, although, you know, a smart jury might just be like they didn't prove it. But the reasonable doubt that he didn't do it is a hard thing to overcome when there's so much motive and those searches exist in some format. Right. Unless they can get their own experts to say these searches didn't happen or these searches are corrupt or something. But I think that just the nature of the crime, the cartoonish nature of the searches, if they're allowed in, he probably will be convicted. And also juries tend to believe that spouses kill spouses. That is a thing. But my other thought is there is like a pattern here. Now, he is accused of killing his wife, soon to be ex-wife, ostensibly. But he also had all this other criminal stuff going on in his life. He probably had stuff that he hadn't yet been caught for. He probably had all this other pressure, you know, financial stuff. And he obviously had a lot to gain if she died with there being a life insurance situation. But that happens in like, and I'm not saying it's, obviously I'm not saying it's right, but it is a pattern in family annihilator and spousal violence murder cases that very often the perpetrator is under like an inordinate amount of pressure. Very often it's financial. It's they've been caught for a crime and it hasn't become public yet and they feel like their life is going to be ruined. This recently happened in a case in New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire, yeah.
Where, very sad case, a woman who was the regional manager of a Wings restaurant, it's like a beloved place in New Hampshire, murdered her husband and two of their kids. And her husband, by the way, was dying of glioblastoma brain cancer. He was a counselor at a regional high school. He was like a beloved guy. She was a beloved woman. She, though, it has come out, had a history of embezzlement. She had actually been fired from a previous job many years ago. And I believed maybe served some time or had some criminal punishment for that embezzlement. She was able to kind of bury that, changed her name, and she was now embezzling from her job at the Wings restaurant. And the guy who owns the restaurant, I will say, has done a lot of interviews, and he seems like such a stand-up guy.
Yeah.
So he basically, his accountant discovered there were hundreds of thousands of dollars missing. This was not a $15,000 case.
No,
this
I think was 180 or something like that.
It was a lot of money that they were able to find right away. But I think that, you know, it's clear that this has been a long-term pattern. And he basically gave her the opportunity to confess. He said, come meet. Bring me your bank statements and we will talk this through. And then she wouldn't do that. And so his hand was forced to bring in the authorities. I think he would have anyway, but I think he would have been, what it's clear to me is he would have been more lenient about pursuing charges if she had come clean. That's kind of what he's intimating. Mm-hmm. He probably still would have, and there still would have been consequences. But basically her life was on the precipice of being ruined. It was going to be public. They lived in this very big house in this very nice neighborhood, and it was a house of cards. And when the House of Cards was about to fall down, she murdered her husband and two of their three kids. And the toddler was the only one that she didn't kill. It is an incredibly sad story. Obviously, I think we should just make it clear, these things almost never happen without some serious mental health thing at the foundation of it. She had been TikToking about her mental health. She was kind of cracking at the seams. And clearly does not excuse killing a man and children. It does not. But I always think in these cases, like, there's mental health stuff behind the embezzlement too. Like, you know, somebody who just has that, you know, that urge that sees this as a solution, that whatever, there's something going on. There's something going on with this art thing with Walsh.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like,
there's a pathology there.
Okay.
It's an untreated pathology there that I think people can get away with in our society because they're able to cover for themselves by looking, quote, presentable.
Yes.
And because people around them don't force them to get help, and because there is no help to get. Like in New Hampshire, there is the social safety net here, the lack of mental health beds. It is a well-documented issue. Just look at nhpr.org and search for mental health New Hampshire, and you'll see this is a long-term issue. So if she did need psychiatric care, it would be hard to come by. So yeah, this is a mix of things. But with the Walsh case, to me, it seems like pressure building, house of cards about to be exposed, and he was going to be alone because she was going to take the kids. And what judge in their right mind would say, okay, they have to spend 50% of the time with you, felon, 50% of the time with their successful mother with a thriving career who's not a felon. Like, no judge is going to do that. They're going to award her custody likely. So he probably felt like his house of cards was about to fall.
Absolutely. And I think at the base of it for Brian Walsh, his image and this idea of himself that he had created was probably the most important thing to him. So he might have been able to keep his friends from knowing about the federal indictment in some way.
That's narcissism, but he wasn't, right?
Yeah, exactly. He was not going to be able to keep his friends and family knowing about his divorce.
Right.
Or that his wife had been cheating on him, or that she was taking the kids. So I think that, I mean, it was such a heinous, horrible way to do it.
But she, quote, disappeared. So you think about that, and a person whose spouse disappears can also be seen as a victim. They can also garner sympathy. This is why everybody thinks Scott Peterson is guilty. I don't want to get into Scott Peterson. I don't want to get into that. But I have serious doubts about that trial in that case. I'll just say that and leave it alone.
Too.
We
might talk about it at some point.
Yeah, the trope of I killed my wife and pretended she was missing is a well-trod trope in pop culture. It's a well-trod trope in Nancy Grace. There are real killers who have done that, like Chris Watts. There are a lot of real killers who have done just that. But what happens is there's a delusion that for a period of time, and maybe some people have gotten away with it, that they're just going to get sympathy and their life will be able to continue on. They'll get the life insurance. They'll be seen as a victim. They'll have their kids. They'll have everything. And they'll just be able to say this person's missing. Like, look at what's his face? Robert Durst. That's what he did with his first wife, right?
Yep.
It's not an uncommon. I mean, it's not common. When I say not uncommon, I mean it's not unheard of thing to have happened. So I suspect that may have been what's going on, is that the House of Cards was about to fall, and he was like, the House of Cards is gonna fall, but I'm gonna make it fall in this other way that benefits me.
Yeah. The interesting thing to me, and we can wrap this up pretty soon, but the interesting thing to me about going forward with the trial, however, is I will say I think the defense actually has a strong argument.
Absolutely.
There's no body. And if they can convince the judge to do away with the tech stuff, if the jury never see, like, look at it this way. If the jury never sees what he was Googling, what evidence is there? Unless they can tie her DNA to the thing, to the, then that's what they're trying to do right now.
Right.
So the saw, the, you know, the things that they found.
The location stuff, you know, going to different dumpsters, going to Home Depot, and buying a murder kit. Yeah. Like, that stuff is sus. For sure.
They are testing DNA right now to see if her DNA is on any of the tools that were used, possibly, allegedly. So if that comes back, I think the DNA could do him in. But if the judge for any reason decides that any of the digital footprint is out and the jury doesn't see it and they don't have a body, there is a possibility he could get off.
Yeah. People do love a no body story.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Maura Murray, for fuck's sakes. This thing has, like, spawned in media empires. Like, right. I have very strong opinions about the Maura Murray case.
I do too.
Which we can discuss in another episode. But and it's not what a lot of content creators think happened.
Interesting.
Yeah. When there's no body, the imagination goes wild.
Yeah.
So, you know, and Robert Durst was a billionaire. You know, he actually got caught getting rid of a body that he dismembered, mm-hmm. and he wasn't able to be charged with murder because the only evidence was him getting rid of the body. So he was charged with, like, illegal
getting
rid of a body or mutilating a corpse or whatever. It was
killed
wild.
Them all, of course.
Being really rich is very advantageous in these situations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So anyway, I don't know what to expect out of this trial, but I know that Michael Proctor fucked it up. I know that much. And I know that, I will say one other thing before we move on. I do find it interesting that they are not looking at the boyfriend in D.C. at all, though.
Maybe they are. How do you know? I mean, if they had investigated him. Yeah.
Yeah.
But maybe they have and maybe they are. Maybe he's been cleared.
He may have been cleared, but I just think it's interesting that she had a whole other life in D.C.
I don't think it's that interesting. Here's the thing. They're probably going to lose, like, all of our subscribers now.
Oh, Jesus.
Affairs fucking happen. So. Affairs happen.
No, they do. Of course.
Nobody would be married if affairs never happened, because half the marriages people you know, whether they admit it or not, came from, I was with somebody, I cheated on them when I fell in love with this person, and now we're together.
Yeah.
Like,
yep.
Affairs fucking happen. Affairs are actually not that interesting. Affairs, generally speaking, are not, for me, a super compelling motive for murder, because even if you are cheating on somebody and you're terrified of getting caught, you are aware that this has happened to millions of other people. You're not the only person in the world who's ever had an affair. You know it's going to suck, whatever. Like, I know plenty of people who've been through this. And it's like the terror. And then when it happens, it's just like, oh, okay, there's like 6 months of it being really hard and then it's fine kind of situation. Yeah. Everybody moves on. So I think the boyfriend was probably in love with her. He probably had an alibi, which is probably why. And I would rather not know whether or not he's been looked at than know he's been looked at and have his name be out there when he actually didn't do anything.
Yeah, they've actually blurred out his name in a lot of the a lot of the news reports that I've been reading and watching. So I'm assuming that they have cleared him. Yeah. But I do find it interesting that there was a whole other life. And on top of that, Anna was, she was from Serbia. She had dual citizenship.
Yeah.
And I think she'd only lived here for like 5 years or something like that.
I feel bad for this woman that this is the man she ended up with, right?
Yeah. I mean, he just kind of bamboozled
her.
He's
a mess.
Like, and I think he did everybody else too.
He's a mess.
He had convinced everybody that he was, you know, this well-off dude because his father was well-off and he went with that. But anyway.
Do you think I could convince people of that? Do you think I could get away with that? No.
Yeah, I think you probably could.
I don't know.
With that hair, come on.
I don't know. I mean, it's like the idea of that being a tenet of your, like a pillar of your whole personality is that it's important for me to have people think I'm well off. It's like these, like, love scammer guys who hang out at Vail ski resorts and convince women that they're rich. And then it's like, I just need to borrow money to pick up my car or whatever. And it's like the artifice of being rich garners so much trust, like, instantly.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I mean, like that's the whole case of Dirty John. And he put scrubs on and everyone thought he was a doctor.
I know.
Because he was handsome. Jeez.
By the way, Tara Newell, a very sweet person. I've talked to her many times. She's a very sweet person.
Totally sweet. I've talked to her as well. She's wonderful.
Unusual person, sweet person.
Yeah. I mean, she's had a very unusual life.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it makes sense. All right. So going forward, I think that what we've sort of decided is that we're going to try to tackle some, like what we did today, some of the more current cases that are happening. And then we might dive into some what we're going to call like vintage cases.
Classics.
Like Menendez. Classics. Things like
that. Deep
cuts. Deep cuts. And basically we're going to try to...
The greatest hits. Sort of,
yeah, exactly. Oh, so sad. You're going to get us canceled.
Oh, all come right. on.
We've only done one episode. The greatest hits. Yeah, so we're going to do these sort of like, we're going to do current cases. We're going to cover vintage cases. If you have a case that we don't know about that you want us to cover or that you seem, you know, you think is interesting, please let us know.
Or that you think we do know about and may have takes on.
That's true. Yeah, actually, if you just want to know what our brains think
about Maura Murray, let us know.
Maura Murray or Peterson. I mean, Rebecca really doesn't want to talk about Peterson, but I do.
There are reasons.
I know, because people get really upset.
Well, they used to get that way with Amanda Knox, too. Like, there used to be this bot army that would come after you. I mean, Amanda Knox didn't fucking do it. You know how I know? Because another guy did, and he went to prison for it. And people,
because of DNA.
Because of DNA. And people just think because they don't like women, and she liked to have sex when she was, like, 20, that she, it's like, it's unbelievable. It's on that, and it used to be that you could not say that. We used to say this on our show 10 years ago, and the hate, I had to shut down conversations in our Facebook group or whatever. And it's like, look at the case. Don't look at your people say, but I feel like, but I have a feeling that that is not a case. Your feelings about something are not what happened. And what happened in that case was that Rudy Guarino confessed to doing it. His DNA was everywhere. He took a shit in the toilet of that house. He was arrested, convicted, and spent time in prison for that murder because he did it. So that's it's not how I feel.
Rebecca
that's what
has
happened.
Feelings. You have feelings.
I have feelings about the people saying that their feelings matter more than the evidence. I really do.
Yeah.
Really
when there's science involved, that's why I'm like really struggling with this case that I'm working on right now, because the guy who's in prison for these attacks was excluded from all of the DNA at the crime scene and had an alibi. Yeah. Tell me how that happens.
And don't think that Adnan Syed is likely guilty because you don't like Rabia Chaudhry. Like, that's not a good reason, or because it's all
Karen
from the boyfriend.
Reed.
Don't fucking do that. Don't do that when there are so much contra evidence to your feelings. Like, take a look. I've had my mind changed so many times about things over the years, because I'm like, I didn't really know that part, you know?
Yep.
And as soon as you know the part, you're like, oh, well, okay. See, even Ruby has thoughts.
Yeah, Ruby has thoughts. She gets all amped up. And when I'm amped up, that's what happened with me with the Pamela Smart case. I spent my entire life thinking that she was this, you know, slut who got her teenage boyfriend to kill somebody. And then I started thinking about it differently. And when I did, I felt guilty. Like, I felt shame that I had sort of put her in this box that everyone else had put her in because of what my family talked about, the way they talked about her around me, and what, you know, what I saw in the news.
And because of the coverage.
Because of the coverage.
And whatever you think, even if you still think that she's a slut who hired somebody to kill her husband, you got to know her trial was super fucked up.
Super fucked up. And you're going to find out soon,
like,
because there's
a
habeas.
Yeah, it's her trial was, just watch the HBO documentary about her trial. It was super messed up. Even if you think she is the worst person in the world, she deserves the same rights as the most vulnerable, sweetest person you know.
Yep, she deserves a fair trial. Anyway, all right, we're going to wrap this up. This was fun, and I'm looking forward to doing this with you every week. And we'll bring a new case next week, and we'll talk about everything that's going on. We are focusing a little bit on like the New England region, because I'm from there, you live there. But I also want to talk about one of the bigger cases that is coming up, which is the Long Island serial killer, which
that's right near my hometown, man.
I know.
Like he lived a few miles away from where I grew up and left bodies. Rex Hoyerman, that case, or Hewerman, however you say his name, that case is fascinating. And if you want to do some homework on it, if you're interested in learning more about it, I recommend that everybody read the book Lost Girls by Bob Kolker.
Okay.
One of the best true crime books ever written. It gives you a very victim-centric look at this case and how these women sort of ended up in this guy's crosshairs. And it's fascinating. And of course, that case is also fascinating because of the fact that he wasn't caught for so long when they had all the evidence right in front of him.
Yeah. And witnesses and somebody who could identify him and his truck and all that stuff. I will put a link to that book, The Avalanche. I will put a link to that book in the show notes. Do you want to tell the audience where they can find you on the socials?
Yeah, you can find me everywhere at Reb Lavoie. And you should really check out my podcast, Crime Writers On. On that show, we basically give you recommendations on what to watch, what not to watch, what to listen to, what not to listen to, and why. We are very good about telling you why something sucks.
And there, yeah, I would say Crime Writers On is one of the original true crime sort of shows I started listening to. You guys are definitely the OGs. And I love the commentary. I love that there are four of you who have usually very different perspectives, even though some of you land on the same side. It's well thought out. You're well spoken. And if I want to know something about a documentary or a podcast that I haven't heard or seen, I usually check out if you've covered it first and then figure out if I want to listen to it or not. I'll be honest.
Where can folks find you, Mel?
You can find me at The In Between Pod on almost all socials, or Real Mel Barrett on Instagram, and Jack of All Trades DC on TikTok. And then with our YouTube, it's basically Something's Off Pod. So I will put links to everything in the show notes. And again, we're going to release this Fridays, and it's going to come out on Patreon. I think I'm going to do the video and the audio on my Patreon.
Smash that subscribe button, folks. Smash it.
Yeah. Definitely smash the subscribe button. I appreciate everybody who's already subscribed, even though we have no content. You're amazing, and I love you. But yeah.
Are we going to give people an opportunity to tip us at some point? Is that going to be a thing?
Yeah, I'm going to include a tip jar. So if you like what we do, you know, there's no budget behind the show or
none.
Most of the shows that we do.
None.
So if you like what we do and you can...
These pillows don't pay for themselves, people.
I'm going to have to start selling Ruby's feet pics on OnlyFans or something. So if you like what we do, please give us a tip and sign up for the Patreon and subscribe to the YouTube. And thanks for everything. And we're looking forward to it.
Thanks, Mel. This was really fun.
Yeah, this was fun. All right. We'll see you next week.